The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
You can find those views in many of his writings, his commentaries, his sermons, and so forth, but preeminently you find them in his preface to the Psalter, which is a marvelous and careful piece of work. His views on music here are Jane, something stopped. His views on music are very much influenced by Plato. And quoting Plato, Calvin says this: music has a secret and almost incredible power to move our hearts in one way or another. That's actually a statement out of the Republic, which we talked about earlier. And from this he concludes that there's two parts to a song: the words and the melody. The melody is able to pierce the heart. And again, I quote him, "As wine is poured into the cask of a funnel, with a funnel, so venom and corruption are distilled to the very depths of the heart by melody." And then from this he concludes, "We'd better sing only the Psalms, and sing them solemnly, with weight and majesty." And finally, he recommends that people abandon the songs that they've previously used, which are vain, frivolous, stupid, dull, foul, vile, and therefore evil and harmful. Instead, they should hereafter sing these divine songs and celestial hymns with the good King David. Now, it's very hard for me to disagree with Calvin on anything, and here I do so only in part. But I think it's an important part, one which has actually led to much confusion in the Protestant Church. He moves from the view that music is substance to his aesthetic ideal of weight and majesty. And then he kind of sets up a dichotomy between the sacred and the secular, which, in my judgment, excludes a number of quite legitimate forms and expressions. Whereas I believe that music is a part of creation, and all of creation is sacred and good. Indeed, there's much diversity in the created world, and not every part of it is appropriately interchanged with every other part. You don't sing the blues or a love song in a worship service. Not that blues or love songs can't be Christian, but that they are not appropriate for that particular service. But I think Calvin went much too far and lost sight of that because of his accommodation to the Platonic ideal. Now, I've come to believe also that music is more like a language than a substance. Music is not an earthly replica of a higher pattern. It's a human activity with divine blessing. Now, on March 2nd, we'll be exploring this much more fully. I'll give you a lecture on music and the Bible. But I think it's important, just for argument's sake, to lay down that distinction here, because it's very different from the picture we get both in Plato's Republic and in Calvin's preface to the Psalter. The power of music is not that it imitates a higher pattern, but that it somehow articulates the meaning of the life of the covenant, the joys, the sorrows, and all the experiences of human life in a fallen but redeemed world. Music is not that different from words. Certainly music is not just a language. But it is like a language in that it has a grammar and syntax and puts things across the way language does. Like language, it has both meaning and power. Music has meaning, and we'll get into exactly how that's possible, because music, after all, is not in words, but it does articulate a message. Like language, music also has power. It's able to speak to the soul. There is truth to all what the poets have said about the tremendous impact of music. Shakespeare, in Much Ado About Nothing, has young Benedict say something about the mystery of music. He says something like, how mysterious, how strange, I think are the words, that souls could be hailed out of men by a mere catgut. And so music has this power. It also can express many different things. Whereas Calvin tends to limit it to weight and majesty. But what about other things that music can legitimately express? Fun or joy, the excitement of praise, the quietness of meditation. What about the deep sorrow of repentance? What about a lullaby? And so on. You see, for the classical model, music can be a drug. According to the music drug analogy, music is a kind of stuff that gets into your system. And it affects you, it moves you, because of its properties. Remember I said that according to Plato, and all of classical tradition, indeed the medieval tradition as well, music was divided into these modes, and each mode had a capacity, simply because of the mathematical organization of the notes, to make you happy, or to make you sad, or whatever it might be. And composers, up until really very few centuries ago, tried to honor that modal system. You would never have music of praise written, you know, like in the Dorian mode, because it wasn't appropriate, and so on. But this view, I think, is in serious error. Not because music isn't powerful, but because the power of music is not as a substance. The power of music is to move the soul, not because of scales and modes, but it's because, like language, music is a metaphor. It's an architecture. It speaks all kinds of different things through conventions, contours, interplay, and 1,000 devices used to create a piece. Now, this is a fine line, but I think it's a crucial one. Plato's approach, based as it is on the philosophy of the forms and the ideal, makes music into a lower kind of being. One that can transport us to a higher state. The Bible, on the other hand, doesn't see music as part of a chain of being, but music as a creature, a gift of God, a human activity. It can indeed speak truth or error, but not because of its psychoacoustical properties, but because, like a language, it articulates a message, and then it's up to us to do with it what we want. So music's not a substance. It can't make us do something whether we want to or not. This, by the way, is what's mistaken about a lot of Christian rock criticism. It has the idea that because it's loud, because it's rhythmical, because the people who play it dress funny, it will get under your skin and make you do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do. I don't want to make too much fun of this view, because indeed there's a lot of popular music that is frightening indeed, and the way to listen to it is to let it get under your skin by all kinds of things that you do. So it's a fine line. But neither rhythm nor pitch nor mathematical arrangement of notes have properties in themselves. The raw stuff of loudness, rhythm, and so forth is not what's going to do something good or bad to you. Evil, for that matter, is not a thing. It's a mysterious rebellion against the good. And so is any art form that articulates that evil. That's the classical model, and many Christians have felt at home with it. Even modern Christians, I think basically C.S. Lewis espoused the classical model. In his writings about aesthetics, experiment and criticism, and a couple of other places, he gives the impression of feeling very much at home with the classical model. That doesn't mean everything he said was sort of mistaken or anything like that. On the contrary, there's a lot of insight here. And I'm trying to say that each of these three points of view will have very strong points. But I also think that Christians were not sufficiently critical in embracing those strong points of the weaknesses. Let me stop there and see if there's any questions or remarks. I know it's infuriatingly succinct. We've just taken care of the classical model in about 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think, thank you. I think the strength is that it recognizes an order of values between higher and lower things, and so it encourages people in the arts and considering beauty to strive for the things that are closer to truth and closer to God. I think that's a real strength of it. I think it mistakenly tells us that the way to get there is to climb a ladder and I think it's also can be arbitrary in the way it assigns a place on the ladder to various things. I've read books, such as here's an example. I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Meyer's book called All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes. It's a critique of modern popular culture, and there's a lot of great insights in it. I mean, he's a tremendous thinker, and he's a very lively writer. But I think what he does in that book is basically to attack any kind of popular art or popular music which became popular because of the market as being necessarily bad music. And he tries to make a distinction, which I think you cannot carry out, between pop music and folk music. For him, folk music is this pure music of the people; it's uncorrupted. And pop music is the marketplace, billboard stuff. It just doesn't work in practice. I mean, what do you do with jazz, which a lot of which sells quite well, but it's really people's music. It comes from the Delta of Mississippi, and it comes from the churches of New Orleans, and it becomes an arbitrary scale of values. So I think the worth of it is that it tells us, yes, there are things that are better than others, and that art should strive for those. The danger of it is that it puts that on a scale that's not really a biblical scale, that's afraid of parts of reality that are just as noble in their own ways. A much better model would be the way Paul talks about the body. You know, everything in the body is good, but there's parts that that don't show, or that are modest. You should be modest about them anyway, and they're just as noble, but they have a different function. And I think that's a much more helpful model than the latter idea. So that's one. Let me see if I can think of anything else. There's bound to be many other good parts to it. I think it correctly points out that the arts influence behavior. That seems like a truism, but in Plato's Republic, he pleads for music as being a part of the training for the moral person. And I think there's something to that. You know, if we subject ourselves to trash all the time, we'll fall into, the corruption of good morals by bad association that Paul warns against, and so on. So that's a point in its favor, even though I've disagreed with the way that they reckon music affects you. I agree with the fact that it affects you. There's a lot to it. It wouldn't have held sway for 2,000 years if it didn't have tremendous strength. And I probably didn't underline them enough. Okay, the second model or worldview we want to talk about is the critical model. What happens beginning in the late 17th century and on to the modern period is a crisis of the deepest sort. We can call it the coming of modernity. And to make a very long story short, it was felt that the older world, including the classical model, was no longer adequate for the human spirit. The classical approach becomes exhausted. A crucial step was taken with Descartes' Discourse on Method, 1637. Another book that probably should read if you're at all interested in the history of ideas. And again, as Lewis says, it's one of those philosophers who's easier to read than his commentators. Henceforth, the human subject would be the starting point of all reflection. You remember Descartes' famous procedure. He tried and tried to find something that would give him certainty. Finally, after pulling back, the onion peels, he came to his great principle, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Only personal thought, he decided, can escape doubt. And from now on, philosophy would have to be done from the bottom up, not from the top down. From now on, the problem would become how to be sure there's a connection between the self and reality. Now, I've condensed a lot of things there. It's a true revolution in the history of ideas. If you want to have a marvelously lively account of this, you need to read Stephen Toulmin's Cosmopolis. He believes that Descartes and his rationalism are kind of the pivot of the modern world. Answering skepticism becomes the central concern of philosophy. And furthermore, the question is, how do you answer skepticism without becoming dogmatic? Or as we might put it today, how do you avoid just the leap of faith? And it took a couple of generations to arrive at the principal philosopher of criticism, which is the proposed answer to this, who is Immanuel Kant. And his three great studies, The Critique of Pure Reason, 1781, The Critique of Practical Reason, 1788, and The Critique of Pure Judgment, 1790, are the boldest statements imaginable of a new way of thinking. Again, to make a very long story short, Kant basically divided the field of knowledge into two. In one realm known as the phenomenal, one can do science. the method of scientific investigation, guided by the certainty of mathematics, assures true knowledge of the sphere of nature, or as Francis Schaeffer called it, the downstairs, or the lower story. In the other realm, known as the noumenal, from nous, we have metaphysical knowledge. Science is out of place here. Only a priori principles exist here. And those cannot be tested. In the noumenal, we have human freedom. And we also have the seat of morality. Morals should never come from some object of desire, but always from what he called the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative. This is the critical model. And Kant's categorical imperatives. So he splits the world into two. Now, how are these two realms related? Well, in the Critique of Pure Judgment, Kant tells us that the mediator between these two realms is beauty. Natural or artistic beauty. The beautiful and art must join together measurable, phenomenal reality to pure freedom. Now, this joining together is not some kind of third higher reality, because that would be going back to dogmatism. Rather, it's a path towards freedom, a true mediator. And I've come to believe there's a kind of idolatrous substitution going on here. The word mediation, that's a Christian word. We have one mediator between man and God, the man Christ Jesus. And just in parentheses, I think a lot of our modern difficulties with the media relate somehow to the attempt in modern technology to substitute mediations of all kinds for the one true mediator, Jesus Christ. Now, I don't mean to imply by any means that somehow, the media are evil or something. But I do think, yes, that's right, we don't want you to lose your job. But I do think that as you study the trends towards increasing mediation between the lower realm of our problems and the higher realm of our freedom in every kind of way imaginable, interactive television, internet, you know, all this sort of stuff, you find a kind of giant substitution of something that is provided by Jesus Christ. This path towards freedom, the mediator, Kant shows us is a kind of aesthetic. He uses Descartes' subject here. Pleasure and pain are connected with judgment for him. And judgment, hence the word critical, is the key to this great irrational freedom. How do you exercise this judgment, and how do you get close to this beauty, which is the mediator? Well, you do it by experiencing the sublime. And that is a major concept in the 18th century, the notion of the sublime. The critical model was challenged almost at its inception by the third model that I'm going to talk to you about, but yet it not only survived, but has many incarnations right up to the present. Today it's being revived by thinkers like François Lyotard, who's the author of all the books on the postmodern condition. He believes that the notion of the sublime is the key for today's art. because it enables us to conceive of what is unrepresentable. And his definition of modern art is art, which includes literature and so forth, that makes people conceive of those realities which are invisible. And I know a lot of artists who believe that's what they're doing. They're making the invisible visible to us. They're giving us a window onto reality. And that, they don't know this, but they're using the critical model. You can do this in a lot of ways. You can say how impossible it is to represent reality, in which case you become nostalgic or regretful. Or you might stress the ability or capacity to represent. In this case, you move in a postmodern direction, breaking up the previous structures and meta-narratives. But in both cases, you're accepting this dichotomy, this dialectic, this two-tiered reality, the natural and the freedom. And beauty is the way to get to freedom. Now, again, Christian thinkers have interfaced with this model. The great French Catholic Jacques Maritain, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he was one of the most important figures in reviving Thomistic Catholicism in Europe in the 20s and 30s, Jacques Maritain. He wrote a book in which he points human beings to the transcendental. How do you get to the transcendental? You get there by art. Art is able to awaken us to the sense of mysterious identity. And I sometimes wonder whether our own thinkers like Doreyfert and Ruckmacher didn't fall into this category to some extent. They talk about a center in the artistic mode. And this center has a lot to do with harmony and aesthetic sense. And the problem, I think, again, for us as Christians, is the beginning point. While Kant is trying to avoid skepticism by saying there are absolutes and moral imperatives, he has no way of guaranteeing that. He's just positing it. He's just saying that there's this noumenal realm up there. He just wants it to be true. In fact, the later philosophers have criticized him heavily for saying, well, that's fine. You want to hold on to something great, but how do you know it's there? Well, he said, I can get there by art. Well, maybe so, but you've got to know where there is before you can promise that you're getting there. The beauty of the sublime is, in fact, almost impossible to define. Everything is finally located in the human experience and the self-consciousness of the sublime. And this, I think, is the problem of the critical model. But Christians, I think, unthinkingly have bought into it, and I think that's given us a number of problems. All right, the third. You ready? How are your hands? The third model, and the final one I want to consider, at least today, is the romantic model. That must be an Esther sigh. Romanticism actually owes a lot to Kant, but essentially the worldview is different. The coming into prominence of Romanticism was at the time of the French Revolution, and its greatest expression is in German idealism, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. Unlike both classicism and criticism, Romanticism doesn't stem from the work of one great thinker, Plato or Kant. There are some key figures, but there's a bunch of them right up to Heidegger. Let me try to be very brief here. In a way, this school probably carries the most weight today. First, where does Romanticism locate the beautiful? You remember the classical model locates it where? You remember the classical model? Where is the beautiful located? Right, being, ontos. And art and beauty are two different things for Plato, leading to the theory of imitation. For Plato, art is actually inferior to beauty. And you have to practice art in order to just be in line for beauty. Where does the critical model locate the beautiful? Not out there in being, but where? Not out there. Yeah, it's in the mediator. And how do you experience that mediator? It's through yourself. It's through your experience of the sublime. It's a transcendental self. So the classical in ontos, the critical in the transcendental self. Beauty can thus be found either in nature or in art, because those are just opportunities for the self to discover its own feelings in the critical approach. Now, Romanticism offers a third possibility. The beautiful is art. Aesthetics is the theory of art. For Hegel, for example, nature is not a part of the study of the beautiful, because it can't be art. It's not man-made. Artistic beauty is a human product, and by definition, it's superior to anything found in nature. Now, this may be very familiar to us, because in modernity, we tend to accept the idea that art is superior to nature. But it's a very recent idea in the history of philosophy. Not only is art the proper study of the beautiful, but the beautiful belongs only to art. It doesn't mean the essence of art is exhausted by beauty. In Hegel, the beautiful is only one particular phase of art, Greek art. And during his own time, art had become Christianized and was dealing with other features, such as subjectivity. For Schopenhauer, art reveals the supreme will that rules the world. So tragedy and evil are a part of the world's coming to age. Okay, so beauty is contained in art, but art is not contained in beauty. Romanticism accords a kind of supremacy to artistic and aesthetic endeavor. This gives us the cult of the genius, for example. For the Romantics, art is superior to philosophy. Imagine that. Art is a kind of savior. Nietzsche has eloquent passages where he affirms that religion, morality, and philosophy are only decadent statements of our humanity, but art is the appropriate counter-movement. You can find this in his Will to Power, fragment 853. And this is why, at least at first, Nietzsche welcomed Wagner as the greatest beacon of the 19th century. Because, as I was saying earlier about his Zukunftsmusik, art, total art, could save humanity. He actually later rejected Wagner because he felt that Wagner was too attached to Christianity, which is hard to see for anybody who looks at Wagner, but also to sentimentalism. I think he confused the fact that Wagner was using certain Christian stories with a commitment to Christianity. Instead, Nietzsche says we've got to look at the Superman prophesied by Zarathustra, and that's what's going to save us. So I think Romanticism, in the way we're trying to understand it here, is still the dominant position. But I think the critical position is in for a comeback. And I won't go into all the people that I think might be doing this. Once again, there's a Christian interface with this school of thought. There's a tradition of Christian equivalencies to this program, without, obviously, a commitment to the paganism involved. You see it in the revival of the idea of creativity, for example. Many Christians are busy trying to give meaning to a disenchanted world by talk of imagination, hidden art, creativity, and so on. The Roman Catholic Church was, in fact, strongly attached to the Romantic movement in the 19th century because it saw in the Romantics a kind of counter-movement against the coldness of Enlightenment rationalism, and it seemed to reinvest the world with meaning. I reckon that some people are returning to things like fantasy or liturgical Christian experience, the so-called Canterbury Trail, because of romantic reasons. Now, this is not to say that they aren't doing it because of legitimate problems with what they're leaving. We had an interesting apostrophe last year, you know, our discussion group. We had the New York author, who's also an elder in the OPC in South Dakota, Larry Wywoody, lead a discussion on fantasy for or against. And I came into the meeting with my gloves on because I love fantasy, and I was expecting him to destroy one of my favorite things. And I was pleasantly surprised that what he was doing is not taking shots at all of fantasy, but he was taking shots at the tendency of some Christians to take refuge in fantasy because they can't deal with the present world. And he was very strong. I mean, I think he was a bit extreme, but he was trying to remind us that the beautiful and the issues of life take place in ordinary reality, in human history, in families and in cities and so forth, not in a faraway never-never land, instructive as that might be at times. So there's a tendency of some Christians who to say not that art saves, but they long for beauty and fulfillment in a similar way as the Romantic long for beauty and fulfillment. And there are huge problems with this. It confuses creator with creature and many things. So that's the third model, and as you can guess, I think that all three of them have huge problems, and I'm going to try to propose next week a very different approach, which will, I hope, glean some of the best features of these three, but also will be critical of some of the weaknesses, and so I'll be giving you some, I hope, some principles of a Christian aesthetic next week, by which we can work on the issues that are involved. What is beauty, and what is the place of art, and why does music have all this power, and so on, but without falling into the pitfalls of classicism, criticism, and romanticism. Okay, let me just pause. Anybody want to say anything or ask questions? Is this stuff way abstract or too, is it, no, okay. Is it way too simple? No, okay. Not that. Okay. Yeah, right, an avalanche, right. Okay. Trying to get a drink out of a fire. Plato couldn't have said it better. Wine in the funnel. Yeah, that's right. The Romantics believed that the only place where you can find beauty is in human artistic endeavor and not the other way around. Beauty, they rejected the classical idea that beauty was this great big universal principle which was only accessed by a few people. Yeah. There's a probably the most influential medieval thinker on aesthetics was a character named Boethius. And he said there's three kinds of music. There's ideal music, which nobody can hear. There's the music of the spheres, which nobody can hear. And then, finally, there's instrumental music, which musicians can do, and which gives people some sense of those other two, but which is a very poor third. So, you know, that's the kind of classical approach in the extreme. And he was very influential on the church fathers, who believed that going to church and hearing Gregorian chant, you were kind of sanctified, by, because you were in contact with the third kind of music, instrumentalis. And you were brought up into the higher kinds of music. Now, the Romantics utterly reject that, and they've utterly humanized music and the arts. The only access you have to art is through human creativity. And that's because Hegel and Schopenhauer and the rest believed that human thought was God. The rational is the real, and the real is the rational. That's what Hegel said. So, what a shift, you know, between that and the medieval view. It's the massive shift from a kind of transcendental being to a transcendental self, from a world where the truth is objective to a world where the truth is completely subjective. In a way, it does, because it so emphasizes the self that beauty is still this kind of mediator. But where it parts company with the critical model is that you don't experience a sublime. You don't have sort of good art and bad art. You just have art. Hegel goes very far. He believes that evil is as much an artistic experience as good, because that's part of humanity. You see, and the critical people would never say that. The critical people would say that only the beautiful, only the pure and the good are beautiful, and they'd never say that evil could intrude.
How does it likewise affect the classical
model? In the Romantic world. No, I think it's very, very different. I'd say there's a kind of a first cousin relationship between critical and romantic, but I'd say there's a different tribe, yeah, divorce between those two and the classical. The only possible link is that some of the Romantics believed that Plato and Aristotle were a necessary first phase before we could get to the present phase. And without them, we wouldn't have gotten here. Well, it's a counterfeit of the idea of the Logos. Christ is, as Van Til would say, fully rational. And God is all truth. and he reveals himself rationally. So that when we look at Revelation, we have access to all truth. He's the image of God, the full effulgence of his being, and so on. Now, what's crucial for us is not to confuse our creaturely knowledge with the knowledge of the Creator. We know after God. We know by analogy. We know dimly, through a glass darkly, and so forth. So that distinction is absolutely crucial. What you have in Hegel is the idea that not only do we know all truth, but the Logos is actually a human principle, really. He called it the world spirit, but the world spirit, when you look at it closely, is a spirit of humanity going towards itself. Humanity is in the process of finding itself. It's in the process of self-discovery. And so in that way, it's a massive counterfeit of the Christian view of the Logos. And in beauty, it works the same way. We would say God, who is the source of beauty, has come and become a man, and he's revealed himself and with his great glory. But we'd never want to confuse our own attempts at doing beauty with his. Whereas Hegel would say, beauty is us, you know. Toys are us. This is it. So it's a devilishly close parallel in some ways. Is that what you're after? Yeah. As you would expect, because here we are in a world, a post-Christian world, where we've had the gospel, and we're now any drift away from it has to still reckon with Christian things. I mean, Hegel really was a kind of imitator of Christianity. He's a Christian heretic. You couldn't have had a Hegel in Greek times. You know, it wouldn't be possible because you wouldn't have anything to imitate except general revelation. Yeah. Let's look at it this way: the location of beauty for the critical model is this mediator that gets you to the transcendental self, and it's the sublime that's where you get it. The location of beauty for the romantic model is the creative process. Okay, it's human creativity. It's art. Art is no longer really an object that could or could not be beautiful. Beauty is art.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, it's Mahler, Berlioz, I mean the great genius, because he's the great creator. He's the great prophet, and he's misunderstood because other people don't have that gift, you know.